exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you. And when I do, I'll see you standing there. A new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and we're available via podcast, either through iTunes where you can go to the public radio page and scan down to KUCI or at Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower on the left-hand side of your screen, which will lead you to our radio page. And from there, you can view prior guests, upcoming interviews, and access our archives to past shows. They're up there now and available to you 24 hours a day for free. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, we bring you live conversations with authors, poets, agents, publishers, all those folks responsible for putting books out into the world. This morning, I'm joined by Molly Glass, and coming up in our second half hour, Rosemarie Kinder will be here, so please stay with me for that. Molly Glass's novel, The Jump Off Creek, is a Pacific Northwest classic, winner of the Oregon Book Award and the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Award, and a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award. The Dazzle of Day, a novel of the near future, received the Penn West Fiction Prize and was a New York Times notable book. Wildlife, set in the woods and mountains of Washington State at the turn of the 20th century, won the James Tiptree Award and in 2002 was selected for the citywide program If All Seattle Read the Same Book. But it's her latest novel, The Hearts of Horses, published by Houghton Mifflin, that we'll be discussing this morning. Molly, welcome.
Thank you.
I have to confess to you that I typically shy away from animal stories, from horse stories, for no reason in particular other than, you know, just kind of personal preference. But I was urged to read this book by a few people, and I really can't tell you how much it captivated me. There are so many ways in which this book worked. So I want to delve into the story and into the construction and how it did work. Tell us about the Hearts of Horses.
Well, let's see. It's set in 1917, in the winter of 1917 and early 1918. A young girl, Martha, is breaking horses for several farmers and ranchers at the beginning of the American involvement in World War I. So the war is in the background of everything that's happening.
Mm-hmm. In your acknowledgement section, you talked about the original inspiration for the novel. Can you talk about where the idea came from and how it germinated in your mind before you wrote it?
Well, it was years ago, actually. I read in Teresa Jordan's collection of oral histories a couple of sentences from an old woman who was talking about what it had been like in her childhood in Wyoming. She said something like, in those days there were girls who came through the country breaking horses. And a couple more sentences than that, but not much. And I wrote them down. This was, I don't know, it must have been 15 years ago at least. Mm-hmm. I wrote down those sentences and didn't really quite, excuse me, know what to do about them. And over a period of years, began to think about who these young girls were, what their lives were like, and gradually began to put together a story that worked for me in terms of the girl who's breaking horses, which I've always thought was something that only men did.
Mm.
Did some research about these girls, discovered that breaking horses, the way that girls and women did it, was quite a bit different from the way we think of in cowboy pictures, you know, where you climb on a horse and just buck him till he quits, that in fact girls had methods very much like the methods we think of as modern horse whispering.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Yeah, so fascinating to, you know, kind of a period feminist piece, and I want to get into that part of it too. You know, oftentimes just don't think of women in this role, and I thought that was interesting too.
Yeah, which of course is why I wrote down those sentences then, because I sure didn't think of women as having done that kind of work.
Right, right. And I want to talk about the setting. Obviously, the sense of place and the sense of time played such a key role in this book. It's grounded, as you said, in Oregon during the winter of 1917, obviously during the First World War. It's almost as if the landscape itself were a character in the work. Talk, if you will, about constructing such a vivid place and bringing to life this time period. I know it's research. What else is it? And perhaps how do you go about the research you did?
Well, I do a tremendous amount of research, and I initially thought I would place the book in Wallowa County, which is a real county in Oregon, in the far northeastern corner of Oregon. I know a lot of people think of Oregon as being green and wet, which it is on the west side of the mountains, but two-thirds of the state is very dry and very much like the west that we think of when we think about cowboy west, the rangeland west. And Wallowa County is a beautiful piece of that, and I thought I would place the novel there, but when I began to do the research, I realized that Wallowa County is a little bit too big for my canvas. I wanted to shrink it a little bit, and I didn't want to be stuck with the actual history of Wallowa County, so I invented a county, and I sort of shoved aside several Oregon counties to make room for mine, but modeled it on a smaller version of Wallowa County. So I was able to use a lot of what I knew about Wallowa County in terms of landscape to describe it. And the history, much of it is like I knew about Wallowa County, but altered in small ways so that I could have certain events happen at certain times rather than at the times that they actually happened and things like that. So,
mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to get at some things to do with the West and the cowboy West and how we think about that, the mythology of the cowboy and so on, which is why I placed it in the West, in that Western rangeland country.
It's funny because I grew up in Walla Walla, Washington, which
on a
good day you could probably walk to
Walla. You know exactly where Wallowa County is.
I did, and it was and you know, as a kid going to the Pendleton Roundup, and
yeah.
You did a great job.
Well, thanks.
That's exactly how it feels.
Thanks.
Now, the structure of the novel kind of struck me as a little bit kind of short stories embedded within a larger story. It's such a natural and brilliant move to have your main character riding a horse circle, mm-hmm. which, you know, naturally lends to a wonderful structure of being able to circulate amongst the characters.
It also works as a great metaphor, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Yeah. And it, you know, it gives you access to these households as she maneuvers around the circle. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you have a sense of these as almost interrelated short stories? Was that how you thought of the structure? Or how did you approach it?
No, not really. Although the circle ride was an important part of my my beginning to conceive of the novel. I've already said that I sort of composted that little bit about girls breaking horses for years and years. And the thing that helped me to move forward from that was rereading a novel from that I had enjoyed as a child, a novel called Diamond Hitch. Mm-hmm. And just a small part of that novel is about a fellow on a circle ride. Mm. And I should probably say what a circle ride is, that somebody breaking horses, a wrangler breaking horses, might work for a number of farms and ranches and with a horse or two at each of them. And he might start out in the morning getting onto one horse that's greenbroke and ride it to the next farm, unsaddle that horse, put it in the corral, saddle a new horse, and ride it on to the second farm, and so on around the circle until he winds up back at the first farm at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And in that way, every horse gets ridden a little bit every day, and you can break several horses that way over a fairly short period of time. And that's what happens in Diamond Hitch. And when I read that, reread that, I realized that could, in fact, make a great structure for this girl who's breaking horses. And that was when the novel began to take shape for me, because I realized then that I could not only write about the story of Martha, the girl breaking horses, but also the stories of several of the people for whom she's breaking horses.
Yeah.
And that's when it began to begin to live for me. I didn't really think of them as short stories, no. I just knew that several of these people would have interesting stories of their own to tell, and that they would interrelate with Martha's story in various ways.
Indeed, they did. They did. So, yeah, some of the minor character stories were, you know, equally engaging, I would say, with Martha's story. You know, I might have you read to us now from the book, now that we've been introduced to it, and I think that'll take us into, you know, more of a discussion of craft and how you did this. Can you read to us?
Sure. Let me just read a little piece in which Martha is visiting one of the people for whom she's breaking horses, and it'll become clear what the issues are as I read.
Great. I'll remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Molly Gloss, author of many things, but most recently, The Hearts of Horses.
She went up onto Irwin's porch and knocked at the door and tightened the throat catch of her hat against the wind, and when he came to the door, she said quickly and forcefully, "Mr. Irwin, your hired man has been whipping some of the horses I'm working with and not feeding them the grain they need." He looked at her in bewilderment. "Loggerwell," he said, as if he had more than one hired hand and was sorting out which one she meant to indict. Walking up the hill, she'd become just about as sore as a boil, at the edge of blazing up if Irwin gave her the least reason for it. She said, more loudly than was needed, "If you're planning to keep on letting him work for you, I'll have to take your horse out of the circle." His brain gradually took in what she had said. "He's been beating on your horses," he said, without questioning it. "Yes, sir, and yours too, and their feed's been going to his wife's pigs, I'm pretty sure." He stood stiffly in the entry of his house, with a book held down in one hand and the other hand resting on the doorknob. He was dressed in his Sunday suit with a plan to attend church, but the book he was holding, marking the page with his thumb, was not the Bible but a history of the French monarchy. "Is he down there right now?" he said, and stepped out on the porch to look down the slope toward the barn and his hired hand's small house. The wind caught the front of his hair and lifted it in a coxcomb, caught the pages of his book and flapped them against the back of his hand. "No, sir, I don't think he is." With the recent change of weather, the mountains across the way were dressed in snow clear down to the valley floor. Irwin turned his head toward them and studied the view for a long minute and then tightened up his mouth and said with a glance toward Martha, "All right, then, I'll take care of it." He started back into the house. She couldn't let it stand that way. She said again, "If you're planning to keep him on, I've got to take your horse off the circle." She would hate to leave Irwin's roan horse behind, hate leaving him in Loggerwell's custody, but she would do it to protect the rest of them. Walter said said to Martha in a slight tone of umbrage, "I'll make it clear to him he's to quit mistreating the animals." He had had trouble from the first day getting his hired man to do much of anything he asked, but he believed his own words. He would make his point with Loggerwell this time and get control of the situation. He had seen the man cruel to his own wife's pigs and to his dog for no good cause. He wasn't much surprised by what the girl had told him. "He'll go on doing it," she said fiercely. "He'll find ways to do it without you knowing." It was her belief, her experience, that when Loggerwell heard it was Martha who'd brought the complaint, he would start looking for ways to take out his grievance on her horses. In truth, Walter Irwin wouldn't have been sorry to see the man go, but he had no experience with firing anyone and little hope of finding somebody else to work for him now that the war had taken so many men off to the army. He said to Martha in exasperation, "If I turn him out, I don't know where I'll get another hand." Martha flared up. "I don't know either, but if you let him go on working here, he'll go on hurting the horses until he kills one, which I won't let happen." Her voice shook from deep feeling, and she cleared her throat a couple of times to try to hide it. She put her hands inside her coat pockets and fisted them. Walter stared at her, taken aback, startled to see tears standing briefly in her eyes. He hardly knew the girl, but on the evidence of her dress and the masculine work she'd chosen for herself, he had formed an opinion of her as hard and leathery, not very much different from the ranch men who were his neighbors, men he believed to be without an ounce of soft feeling or the capacity for sentiment. Martha went on looking at him heatedly with her chin squared and her fists working inside her coat. Her silence and her stubborn stare made him feel put upon, provoked into taking some kind of action. He turned from her again and looked out at the mountain range without seeing it, and in a moment found the gumption to put himself on the right side of the question.
That was Molly Gloss reading from her book, The Hearts of Horses, published by Houghton Mifflin. That was amazing. And it brings me to one of the central things that was so great about this, which was the language and the dialogue. And like I said at the beginning, I don't read a lot of Western set novels. And so I was so taken with the verbs used and the nouns used. And, you know, I didn't know there were so many ways to describe a horse and to describe the parts of a horse. And the language in this was really just incredible. I assume there's a cadence to Western fiction.
Well, I think that what you're hearing might be something that I hear, a sort of syntax as well as a vocabulary that I pick up from one of the aspects of my research. When I'm working on a book, one of the things I do is read quite a number of novels written in the period in which I'm working. So I read quite a few novels written around 1917, 1918, because you pick up from them not only details about life, about, you know, how houses were furnished or what stores were like on Main Street, but you also just pick up that vocabulary, the syntax of people's speech and so on, and I find it a really useful way to approach the writing of a period piece.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's true. It is syntax along with the language. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was jotting down some of the subjects that this novel covered, and there were many. You know, there were in the background, there's racism and feminism and alcoholism and disability, war, death, marriage, relationships. Yet I wouldn't necessarily say these were, you know, kind of the central areas of concern or the big questions, some more than others. But the reader wasn't overwhelmed, or I wasn't overwhelmed, by the depth and breadth of the subjects that you covered. I'm curious first about kind of your central concerns as the writer, what the big theme was for you in your mind.
Well, I guess one of the things that I'm always writing about in all my work is the human place on, the human response to, the human relationship with landscape. So that's a central core issue that I think I'm always writing about, and in particular the Western landscape. And because of that, I'm also always sort of thinking about and writing about the cowboy mythology, what that's meant to our country, how it has shaped American culture. And Martha is someone who has bought into that myth. She's someone who reads cowboy novels and imagines that herself as a kind of modern day. She thinks of herself as modern, a modern day cowboy. And one of the things I think that's happening in this book is Martha rides into the valley in the same way that many strangers rode into the beginnings of Western fiction, including Shane, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And those cowboys, nearly always at the ends of those novels, ride out of the valley again. They've solved the valley problems with a gun and then ride off into the wilderness. And this doesn't happen with Martha. She thinks it will. She thinks she's going to ride in and break some horses and ride out again. And instead, finds herself part of the community. And for me, that's another way of thinking about the cowboy myth, a refiguring of the cowboy myth, putting community at the center of it instead of the lonesome cowboy, the solitary, independent cowboy who chooses loneliness over the obligations and the embrace of community.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really good point, because Martha became very embedded in some of these families, and, you know, obviously more involved in their lives than mm-hmm. than just the breaker of their horses.
Right.
And in so doing, you know, it was so there were, like I say, some of the sub stories were so interesting. There's a family that's probably the most visceral part of the novel for me, who the husband is dying of cancer, and I'm always curious. I read an interview that you did on drawing from life experience to write fiction, and discovering kind of that which is sacred and therefore off limits material, and that which can be mined for fiction. And I assumed some of that was mined for fiction, but you had talked about there being material that, you know, that you couldn't use.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could talk for a moment about that, about what how difficult it is to look at your own life when in dialogue with fiction, and when you decide, you know, what to include and what not.
Mm-hmm. In general, I've been a writer who hasn't written directly about my own life. Even people who know me would not necessarily recognize aspects of my life in my fiction. In this book, I've come closer to that than I ever have before, because, in fact, my husband died of cancer. And so after he died, I didn't write at all for 3 years, not at all. And and then as I began to conceive of this novel, I knew that I wanted a place in it for my husband at a number of levels. He was a really sentimental guy, and he always used to complain to me that I didn't let my girls fall in love. So I knew that, for one thing, that this would be a love story, that Martha would, in fact, fall in love. But I also wanted to write about what I'd experienced and what my husband had experienced when he was dying of cancer. And part of that came out of a feeling I had while I was watching him, helping him die, that I felt somewhat betrayed, actually, by popular culture, by fiction and film, in the way it had portrayed a death by cancer. Mm. That very often in that fiction and in those films, the death is clean and simple and sweet. The person at the end is able to say the loving things, and then their hand holding the loved one falls to the clean sheets, and that's the last moment. And that certainly was not my experience. And so I felt that I hadn't, in some ways, fiction had not been honest in its portrayal of that. So I came to this wanting a place in it for that story. I wanted to be more honest about a death by cancer. And I did. I tried hard to be honest about that. I think I have been honest, but there are lines I didn't cross. There are things I didn't write about, because it would have felt in those cases to be a betrayal of my husband, of his dignity in some ways.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what you read in the story about Tom dying is honest but not complete, I guess is what I would say.
Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how moving that section is. It's very hard to read, but you're right. That is how it happens, and you're right. Fiction rarely portrays it the way that it happens. Unfortunately, we're drawing kind of down on our time, but I was wondering if you could offer advice or wisdom. Most of our listeners are writers themselves, and any words of encouragement or advice?
Read a lot and write a lot. I just think that apprentice writers often think they're ready before they are. They take classes before they are ready for them, or they take classes but don't have the follow-through to keep at it. It's a discouraging thing to write and not find a place to publish. So what I have seen in students when I've taught writing is that very often my best writers are not the ones who become later successful, because they often let other parts of their life sort of take precedent and the writing doesn't happen. The ones who succeed are the ones who keep at it, the ones who keep writing.
Oh, great.
And,
yeah.
And I think you just need to write every day also.
And I think you had talked about writing with, did you talk in an interview about writing with a child? And
Yes, I have talked about that. Quite a bit, as a matter of fact.
Letting him roam the house.
I didn't really become serious about writing until I was a mother. And, you know, it sort of focused me and gave me something serious to write about, made me a more grounded person, I think. I think I would have been, I don't know, an ivory tower intellectual or something had I not had a child. So writing was a way to make a space for myself in a world where I was mostly just a mother and a wife. And so I think even though at the time I felt like my writing life was circumscribed by the child, it actually was also the motivation for being a writer.
Oh, that's great. You know, it was funny as I was reading that interview, and, you know, my daughter was on her fifth hour of television, which I don't allow during the week generally, but I was, you know, prepping the interview, and I saw that in your interview, and I started laughing because you said he was, you know, kind of running through the house willy-nilly while you were trying to get your writing done.
I was encouraging him to go out and play in the street while I was, my joke.
That was very resonant at the time.
Yeah.
It is hard. It's hard to manage all of all the jobs. This was great. Molly, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. This, amongst other things, was a great lesson for me to step outside of the regular genres that I typically read within and explore some other fiction, because this really is one of my favorite reads in the past several months. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'll be joined by Rosemarie Kinder, so please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby,